Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
It's always a bit of a contradiction to say that somebody needs no introduction because one regularly proceeds immediately thereafter to the introduction. This is Alex here, Alex Nicely. And the person who needs no introduction, I'm not wrong here, is Professor Deirdre Kelly. Professor Kelly, well, Professor Kelly trained as a hepatologist and then said, I want to take on something that's really unexplored, that needs as much clout and intellectual steam as I can give it. And she took on pediatric hepatology, founding and since then largely directing a pediatric hepatology unit in Birmingham in the United Kingdom. When she was an adult hepatology registrar and young attending, she took all the prizes, and that didn't change when she moved into pediatrics. And she and I have known each other personally rather than through academic acquaintance for 20 years. When I first arrived in the United Kingdom, she extended the hand of friendship and invited me up to give a little talk in Birmingham at her unit. And I appalled her dreadfully. She asked, is there anything that you'd particularly like to see among the refreshments at the little do we're going to be having, the treats that are handed out after a talk? And I said, yes, please, beetroot. And I'm not sure that she's ever forgiven me for that one. She shook her head as she handed me the platter of beetroot and said, never had anybody ask for this before. But I think we've repaired the breach that may have caused. I hope so, anyhow. And I'm delighted to welcome her to today's SBGAN podcast. Professor Kelly, it's a treat to see you again.
Well, Alex, it's a great treat to see you, and I'm sure your ability to eat beetroot has improved now that you live in Hungary, and your recipes have extended beyond the one that we offered you in Birmingham.
The first line of every Hungarian recipe that I've ever encountered is, take something that used to be a pig. And after that, of course, beetroot comes in for heavy play. Yes, indeed. We go back a little bit in terms of back and forth commentary on one of the things that you've made a particular specialty of yours, and that is the outcome of pediatric allograft livers and the unsuspected perils of fibrosis and inflammation in patients whose biomarker values are not particularly elevated. Tell us what's new in that.
Well, let me tell you how I started, because when we started the transplant program in Birmingham, we were putting adult livers into small children. And my first question was, would the liver age with the donor or would the liver age with the child?
Yes, yes.
And I don't think that's completely understood. But that was why we started our surveillance protocol biopsy program.
How often did you take the biopsies and at what intervals?
Well, we started off with 1, 5, and 10 years, and we actually found that most of the biopsies at 1 year were completely normal. And so we dropped the first year, and we just persisted with 5 and 10 years. But by 5 years, we found significant inflammation, graft hepatitis is what we called it, in the livers at 5 years, and a significant amount of fibrosis. But it was the hepatitis that struck us most at 5 years. And as a result of that, we changed our protocol. In those days, the children were maintained on a single agent, cyclosporine in those days, and we reintroduced steroids as maintenance therapy. And quite interestingly, when we reviewed this again, the hepatitis diminished. But what did not disappear was the fibrosis. And so by 10 years post-transplant, about 60 to 70% of the children had varying degrees of fibrosis.
So fibrosis is significant enough to interfere with graft function?
No, only in a very small percentage. But this drove us to establish the graft injury group.
Yes.
And that's been running for about 10 years now. And so we have published last year in transplantation, a retrospective study of 12 centres of children who received protocol biopsies at 5 and 10 years. And by protocol biopsies, I mean no, they were not performed for any reason other than the protocol, so they didn't have suspected infection, rejection or anything else. They were children with normal biochemical hepatic transaminases and normal other markers and normal ultrasound. And actually, the experience that we originally described in 2006 in Birmingham was replicated across European, New Zealand and US centres. So we had a very powerful group of children whom we followed to look at the long-term outcome of these livers.
And this was irrespective of whether dual or single agent immunotherapy?
No, obviously the every unit had their own protocol. By in the early part of the years, most of the children were on cyclosporin.
Yes.
And towards the end of the time, most of them were on tacrolimus. But it was variable whether they were maintained on steroids or azathioprine in addition. But we were able to stratify for that and to look at the effects. But essentially, what we found was that the fibrosis, that the hepatitis was a very early phenomenon, and largely in children who were maintained on steroids or azathioprine, they did not have significant hepatitis. But fibrosis persisted, but it was dynamic. In some children, it regressed with time, and some children, it progressed with time. But only a very small percentage, 10%, of these children with significant portal fibrosis at 10 years lost their grafts, very small percentage. The majority of children remained stable, physically well, and the implication for us was these children are now going into adult life, but they will need follow-up in adult life because if this fibrosis continues,
indeed,
they will end up with cirrhosis. The difficulty is, Alex, that my adult colleagues don't believe that they need to follow these children up as meticulously as we have, because their own patients, their recipients of liver grafts, do not live long enough to develop fibrosis in the way the young people who now, maybe many of them, are 15 or 20 years post-transplant. So it's proven very difficult to persuade them to follow them up. The best that we've managed to do is to get them to do annual fibroscans to see whether there's any degree of stiffness in the liver and any development of splenomegaly. And I hope that they will do that, because in some of the early days, people would ring me up to say, oh, we retransplanted your patient and they were cirrhotic. But of course, they hadn't been following them up. But if we move on to why this happens...
I was hoping you would.
I think we don't have the answer. My personal view is this is a form of chronic rejection. Because the one that the children have... The grafts have become accustomed to. We've looked at lots of different factors. We've looked to see whether having more rejection in the early days was a cause. That's not significant in this very large group of young people. We've looked to see whether CMV was a significant factor. Again, it wasn't. The only thing that really stood out was whether they had maintenance steroids or not. And curiously, if they had maintenance steroids, they had less hepatitis, but they seemed to have more fibrosis. So it's not really understood why that is. And the study I'd like to do next would be prospectively in young children being transplanted now on very modern immunosuppression to see, in fact, do they develop hepatitis or fibrosis, or whether they are better protected with their livers.
Thinking about azathioprine and its effects, I have to bring up the subject of microthrombosis and of altered perfusion patterns that may not be due to rejection per se, but that may manifest as a sort of fibrosis in the allograft. Have you controlled for that?
No, we couldn't do that, Alex, because it was a retrospective study, but we could do that prospectively. We can't do that retrospectively.
I was wondering if, so many things that one would like to see done or like to have seen done are beyond us.
The other theory was that perhaps the fibrosis was related to donor-specific antibodies, and that's been, you know, considered a theory. Now, we do know that acute rejection, very severe acute rejection, is associated with donor-specific antibodies, or DSAs. But we heard, in fact, only yesterday in the liver section, a big study from Tübingen, from my colleagues in Tübingen, in which they found no difference in the incidence of DSAs at rejection and fibrosis or inflammation in their patients. So in other words, most of the children had some level of DSAs. If they had if they were on lower levels of immunosuppression, they tend to have higher measurable levels of antibody, but no difference in the graft histology, no difference in outcome or rejection. So I don't think DSAs are the answer. But as I say, my best theory is that it was a form of chronic rejection in the early days in which the livers have become tolerant to.
I have the greatest respect for Professor Sturm. Is he involved in...
Professor?
Sturm. Eckhard Sturm.
No, I don't
he
think
He was
so.
Not involved in this Tübingen study.
Oh, he may have been involved in the Tübingen study. I wouldn't remember all the
all
names.
All the co-authors, yeah.
No, I wouldn't know all the co-authors.
Regardless of my respect for him, that will need to be validated, that particular set of observations. And I'm sure that you've already got somebody on your team working on assessing donor-specific antibodies and their relationship to rejection in the Birmingham population.
We have not managed to do that in the Birmingham population because the cost of doing DSAs is very high. And unless you have a grant to do it, it's not possible to do it. But we do have a pathology group in graft injury group in which Jake Demetrius and Stefan Hubscher were the leads initially. Mm-hmm. And now Rachel Brown from Birmingham has taken over from Stefan since he's retired. And she's got a very active interest in that. So it's I'll certainly suggest
it to.
It's
a matter of time, yeah.
Yes.
Fantastic. How does the biliary tract fare in all this?
Well, that's another ongoing project, which the group from Italy, from Bergamo, are very keen to follow up. We excluded it from our study anyone who had biliary abnormalities because they would not have had a direct protocol biopsy. So the bile ducts were not damaged in the groups that we looked at because they were excluded, anyone with any biliary damage.
But they were excluded in terms of doing a biopsy at all?
No, they would have had biopsies, but we didn't include their biopsies in our retrospective review. If they had a biopsy for cholangitis or obstruction,
But among your patients who had no clinical biliary tract disease, you encountered some who, at protocol biopsy...
Not many. But we want to go back and look at that because they weren't specifically looking for the biliary damage. But the Bergamo group feel that there was probably silent biliary damage.
I should expect that if the fibrosis affecting the portal tracts also impaired cholangiocyte metabolism to some extent, but it's all in the observation and in the study, isn't it, rather than in the expectations?
Well, one of the papers that the graft injury group produced was an agreement on how to histologically score and assess post-transplant biopsies. And Jake and Stefan Hubscher were the senior authors on that paper that came out before our natural history paper.
And what did they recommend for the bile ducts?
I can't remember, Alex.
Nor can I. I was hoping you would rescue me.
Definitely not.
What about the distribution of fibrosis? Portal-based or central lobular predominant?
Both. So it depended on which stage. Now, you may remember this better than I do, but there was significant portal fibrosis. That was the most striking feature.
But the central lobular fibrosis pattern, of which I at least think as pointing toward an autoimmune disorder, was not manifest.
Initially, we were drawn to consider an autoimmune etiology because we found positive autoantibodies in the Birmingham group, which disappeared when we restarted the steroids. So ANA and SMA largely. But the other centers didn't find that. And we didn't find significant elevation of IgG either. So the autoimmune side of it, I think the autoimmune, the de novo autoimmune hepatitis was different to what we were seeing.
Very good then. Thank you very much. Where are you going to take this next? You've talked about the follow-up of, well, I'm sure there's, if you can persuade your adult colleagues to get with the program and do a biopsy, then that's one leg to be followed out in terms of longer and longer, further and further. But what else?
Well, I think we'd like to go into the mechanistic reasons for the fibrosis. And so we are enlarging the group to include people who are interested in the development of fibrosis and antifibrotic drugs. So I've always wanted to know what the mechanisms were, but it's not my particular special area, so I need to have some others that will do that. But now we have so much better techniques for looking at fibrosis, you know, down to single cellular level. That I think that would be interesting to do. I also think that we need to be thinking about targets for therapy. You know, are there particular risk factors that we should focus, that we can tailor the immunosuppression or use different immunosuppression or maybe even use antifibrotic drugs? But what has been difficult is to do anything prospectively, as the ethics and the data transfer and all of that has become increasingly difficult. So that whereas it might be reasonable to do it within one centre, trying to do that across different centres without the backing of pharma or someone with real resources is quite difficult. I have handed over the chairmanship of the graft injury group to Stefan Hartleaf, and we discussed some projects that he would just at the beginning of this meeting, and they will focus around looking at the vascular, any vascular abnormalities, say any biliary abnormalities, and consideration for a prospective therapeutic trial.
It seems to me that it might be possible to look at the degree or the extent, maybe using mRNAs, in situ hybridization techniques, the extent of macrophage activation, and to see whether or not the liver looks busier in an H&E section, at least, in the patients who then go on to develop more substantial fibrosis.
It's a question of whether they have sufficient early biopsies to be able to do that, but you could do that prospectively. And one of the studies we'd hope to do is to do prospectively one-year biopsies before the liver gets too damaged, do a variety of biomarkers, including DSA and other biomarkers, and then follow these children. But that has been proven quite difficult to do without significant resource.
I should like to be involved, but as you know, I've moved into retirement and I barely can keep my hand in with so many other projects. But I'm sure that any institution that follows a reasonable number of pediatric liver transplant patients will be delighted to contribute. There's no difficulty in tracking you down and in proposing oneself or one's patients.
Absolutely
to be
not.
Included. All right, then. Well, let me recommend to my listeners, our listeners, that they get on the stick and get in touch with you.
Yes, the person to get in touch with is Stefan Hartleaf of the Graft Injury Group.
And where is he based? I'm sorry.
He's based in Tübingen.
Tübingen, of course. Okay.
With Eckhard Sturm. And so I think I'm sure you can put at the end of your podcast his contact details. He'd be delighted to have anyone join him.
Folks, I'll try to be sure to do that in the little cover note that I append to all of the conversations that we have in podcast form. You'll have to locate that on the website, but it'll be there for you. Professor Kelly, what else would you like to tell us? Because we're almost running out of time and I need to let you select the important message that I haven't managed to touch on.
Well, I think the important message is that 30 years ago, liver transplantation in children was experimental. It's been life-changing for those young people. We've demonstrated that they can grow up. 80% of them are still alive. Many of them are parents themselves and have education and careers. And in fact, they're healthier than many other teenagers of their age because they don't drink so much, they don't smoke so much. and those who survive the non-adherence and risk-taking behavior of adolescents do very well. And not only do they do very well, they've stimulated people like you and me to ask the difficult questions about what causes liver disease. Because now we know we can help these children survive, that gives us a reason to find out more about it and to put it right.
It's a very worthwhile activity, or at least in organizing my life and coming to some sort of sense of purpose. I'm very happy to have encountered the liver. Ron Jaffe, whom I'm sure you knew, said, "What is life without the liver?" And I think we, you and I, can unite in saying, well, of course, to have a proper life, one needs to be involved with the liver.
Absolutely, at all levels.
With that, behind us, what sort of song have you chosen for our listeners to accentuate a little bit of your personal history? I know that you were born in Ireland.
I was born in India.
I knew nothing of this. It is a standing theme that whatever I think I know about somebody in these podcast sessions is contradicted the moment I bring it out. You were born in India.
I was born in India.
Born
and reared in India of Irish parents. But the song I think that I would like is the one my mother used to sing to us when we were small, and that was Danny Boy.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Thank you for taking part in the Espigan podcast series. We've really enjoyed having you here.
Thank you, Alex.